uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome to our program, my friends, the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where reason and passion go together like Republican presidents and gay hookers. Broadcasting live all across the United States on radio stations from Oregon to West Virginia. Streaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system. Beaming around the planet on radiopower.org, a listener-supported radio station. And put a plug in. If you are a listener, please support your listener-supported radio station. And whiterosesociety.org, same deal. American FM on Live 365. Welcome back to our program. Rama Schneider here, line producing the program, as he does on Mondays. Rama also you can hear on Sunday nights on GRR Radio, GRRradio.com. His program with he and Grace give you a real sense of Vermont, if you want to tune into that. And I believe it is... I'll have to find out where there might be archived. I'm sure off his website you'll have the information, grrradio.com. The Reverend Lewis P. Shelton, head of the Traditional Values Coalition. You know, it's getting to where you can't tell from the name of an organization what they're about. There's so many, you know, it's like the Clear Skies Initiative and consumer rights organizations who are actually media fronts. And in any case, this is a traditional value. I guess you get the sense that he's one of these, how would you say it, Christian groups who ignore many of the teachings of Jesus, you know, about the poor and not judging, but like a laser focus go on to Paul's comments about gays. In any case, the greatest blessing, he says, from the Schiavo case is that people are realizing that the court system in America has dictatorial control over too many people's lives. Now, this is really interesting because the law in Florida says that if you're not capable of making decisions for yourself, your next of kin is, and it defines the hierarchy of next of kin, first husband, then parents, then siblings, and, you know, it's right there in the law. And so what we have here is a judge, Michael Greer, who has simply been applying the law. Very straightforward. And when this went to the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, Judge Edward Carnes, the U.S. 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, in the majority that upheld Whittemore's ruling, this was the first federal judge to look at this, he was appointed by President George H.W. Bush. Democrats opposed his nomination, by the way, at the time. And the only judge in this three-court panel, the federal court panel, who voted to uphold Schiavo's parents on the losing side of that 2-1 decision, was a Clinton appointee, Charles Wilson. So I think we can safely say that when these folks say that they're opposed to activist judges, what they're really saying is they don't like the laws. Because what this judge in Florida has done is the opposite of judicial activism. Judicial activism is broadly defined by those people who define it as such, and I'm not going to disagree too much with that, is when a judge says, okay, the law is kind of vague here, so I'll make up a law. I'll decide what the law is. But what this judge has been doing, Greer, down in Florida, is he's been saying, the law is very clear, and I'm simply saying, you got to follow the law. You don't like the law, change it. And the Texas legislature, in fact, tried to change it, and they couldn't get enough votes in the Senate to pass the law. No, wait a minute. They did change the law, as a matter of fact. They passed Terry's law in 2003, and the Texas Supreme Court overruled it as unconstitutional. And again, that wouldn't be judicial activism. That would be saying, sorry, the Constitution says you can't do that. You can't create a law for one person. You can't make the... So it's all these guys running around, oh, judicial activism. And see, this, of course, is the setup for the great Supreme Court fight that is coming. There's all this posturing, just like, I've been telling you this for months, just like this whole Social Security scam that George W. is running around touting. is really the beginning of the dismantling of Social Security. And the only way they believe that they can make it happen is to talk to that generation that doesn't have any institutional memory, any collective memory of a time in the United States when most elderly were poor. In fact, most Americans were poor. And that being people under 30 in particular, people under 50 broadly, but particularly people under 30. And they don't care if they win or lose. I mean, they would like to win. And as we get into the program, I'll share with you who some of the contributors to George W.'s campaign were and why they would like to win. Of course, they would like to win. But if they lose, they still win if they can convince people under 30 that Social Security is a bad deal and that, well, broadly, it's a philosophical thing, that the government programs are bad and that private corporate-run programs are good. This is their agenda, is to convince people under 30, hey, you're going to get, they're saying that that people will get a better deal, they'll get a better return on their investment if they put their money with private corporations than if the government handles it. And, you know, in some cases that's true, in some cases it's not. The reality is that Social Security has never missed a payment in all these 70 years. The reality is that if you look at the proposals that have been put forward by the Bush administration, people will actually lose out, not to mention the massive debt that we'll go into. But it doesn't matter about the reality of the situation. What it matters about is the perception. Creating the perception in people's minds, government bad, private corporation good. This is about moving America from a democratic republic to a fascistic nation, to a nation where corporations rule our lives rather than we, the people, ruling our lives through our elected representatives or making the decisions, the collective decisions, where collective decisions are necessary. Obviously, in both cases, we think that it would be best if we ourselves ruled our lives. Thank you very much. But there are areas where we interact with the commons. We go out on public streets, so we have streetlights, and we all agree, red light means stop.
Well, but wait a minute, you're infringing on my freedoms.
Yes, but it works out better for everybody that way. Our water supply, hey, you know, it's pure water, fresh water. But somebody could make some money off it. And see, this is the next big argument. Of course, this is already happening in a dozen cities in the United States, hundreds of cities all over the world, where you've got huge multinational corporations coming in and saying, let us take over your water supply. Like the deal that Jeb Bush had with Enron to privatize the Everglades before Enron went down. So anyhow, with regard to the Social Security deal, what it's really all about is the long-term strategy, the Heritage Foundation, Cato Institute, long-term strategy of changing the minds of young people to create a generation of conservative Republican rule and roll back America back to the McKinley administration, back to the 1897 and 1901 period, back to that time when the robber barons ruled everything and there was no middle class for all practical purposes. There was a terrified working class that was working 50, 60, 70, 80, 90 hours a week, certainly between two people in a family, husbands and wives both working, in many cases children working, and as a result they were politically impotent. They didn't have time for politics. They didn't have time to show up at political events. So that's what's going on, in my opinion, with the Social Security thing. And we're seeing the same thing with this whole Schiavo thing, that it's not about Terry Schiavo. There's 30,000 people in America in persistent vegetative states. What's the Congress going to do? They're going to call an emergency session every 30 seconds? I mean, if they did, you know, one every 2 minutes, it would take years. No, it's not about that. It's about saying, and it's not even about erring on the side of life or not and all that kind of thing, because, as I'll tell you in a minute, Tom DeLay pulled the plug on his own father. Not about that. What it's about is saying the courts are out of control. You've heard it over and over and over again on right-wing talk shows, right-wing commentators on the Sunday morning shows, on faux news, on right-wing talk radio. The courts are out of control. These activist judges, they're all running around. They're trying to take over. Are we going to have a nation of by and for? We the people are of by and for the judges. Like the judges are out of control. When the judges simply are enforcing the laws that were passed by our elected representatives. Now, why would they be saying such absurd things? Because they are going to put forward, when Rehnquist or one of the, I mean, we've got, what, four now Supreme Court justices who are in their 80s or pushing. Ruth Bader Ginsburg had cancer. Rehnquist has cancer. Yeah, on it goes. There will be, in all probability, three openings in this term, these next 4 years, not this Supreme Court term, but this presidential term, and possibly as many as four. And they're going to be putting forward extremist judges who will rule that government should play a greater role snooping in our personal lives, telling us that certain types of sexual activity are criminal, telling us that, you know, the United States already has 2.1 million people in prison, more than any other nation on earth on either a per capita basis or in absolute numbers. We have more people in prison than the Soviet Union did. We have more people in prison. I mean, it's unbelievable. Well, we should have a few more, they'll say. Let's criminalize a few more things. Let's go back. Let's roll back the Cunningham case, the Cunningham versus Connecticut. In 1965, and make birth control for married couples illegal. Let's agree with Scalia that there is no right to privacy in the Constitution. See, they're going to roll out these guys, and they're going to say, see, the Schiavo case proves that our judiciary is out of control, and we need to get some good conservative judges in here who will make the right decisions. That's what this is all about. Not to mention the added side effects of Tom DeLay getting, you know, his little problems being overlooked. In fact, the patient was then, this from the Los Angeles Times, patient was then a 65-year-old drilling contractor, badly injured in a freak accident at his home. He was in a coma, kept alive by intravenous lines and oxygen equipment, Charles Ray DeLay. Maxine DeLay, Tom DeLay's mother, his 81-year-old mother, with whom he no longer speaks, says, there was really no point of even talking about it. There was no way Charles, her husband, DeLay's father, wanted to live like that. Tom knew, we all knew, his father wouldn't have wanted to live that way. Doctors told Tom DeLay that his father would be basically a vegetable, said the congressman's aunt, Joanne DeLay. And looking at the medical records, extraordinary measures to prolong life were not initiated in agreement with the family's wishes. Do not resuscitate. On December 14, 1988, Tom DeLay's father expired with his family in attendance. Both Tom DeLay's father and Terry Schiavo severely brain damaged, both incapable of surviving without medical assistance, both expressed a desire to be spared from being kept alive by artificial means, and neither of them had a living will. Tom DeLay pulled the plug on his father. But when it's Terry Schiavo, oh, this is his opportunity. 20 minutes past the hour.
Attention, Tom Hartman listeners. I'm here with Brush Lintball.
This is the old Brush Show, Brush Lintball.
To tell you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
She thought I was all right in a sort of a limited way for an off night. She said, don't I know?
Yeah, welcome back. 24 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Tom DeLay's father, he was different. You see, he was, they had to use surgery. They had to use medical devices to help him breathe and things like that. Well, one of the things, it just amazes me how it's overlooked. People keep saying, Terri Schiavo is being denied nutrition. She's being starved. But the reality is, I mean, if you want to base this, if you want to define God's will, let's put this in the theological realm, as, you know, sort of our body telling us it's time to go or not. And so that's the justification for saying, okay, Tom DeLay should pull a ventilator on his father because it's artificially keeping him alive. It's a machine. The reality is that if you put anything in Terri Schiavo's mouth, she cannot swallow it. So much of her brain has dissolved into spinal tissue. When they did the CAT scan of her skull, they discovered it was mostly filled with fluid. There's no brain in there anymore. And so you put something on her tongue, you put moisture or food into her mouth, and she will inhale it, and it'll get into her lungs, and she'll get pneumonia, and she'll die. You cannot feed her. So in order to give her a feeding tube, they had to perform surgery on her, drill a hole through her stomach, through her abdomen, into her stomach, and insert a feeding tube. Now, you tell me that that is not medical intervention? Oh, well, Tom DeLay's dad was different. His was medical intervention. Excuse me, you drill a hole through my stomach, I'm going to tell you, you're intervening medically. Did I say military intervention? It's medical intervention. Not only that, after his father died, Tom DeLay then sued the company that made the bearings for the contraption that Tom DeLay's father had the accident in, and sued for, among other things, physical pain and suffering, mental anguish and trauma, and the mother's grief, sorrow, and loss of companionship. Their lawsuit also alleged violations of Texas product liability law. These are all lawsuits that, under the tort reform that that Tom DeLay shepherded through Congress last week, 2 weeks ago now, would be illegal. He got $250,000 out of this thing, by the way. In 1996, DeLay backed a measure that would, just like the one that Bush has just signed, to reform the legal system, and Clinton vetoed it. He said it tilts against American families and would deprive them of the ability to fully recover fully when they are injured by a defective product. But that's only a third of it. Number one, he pulls the plug on his father. Number two, he then sues the manufacturer of the product that harmed his father in a way that he now wants to make illegal. And number three, the champion of family values, this from the Washington Post, May 13, 2001. For all of Tom DeLay's public espousal of Christian values, particularly his deep commitment to family, he privately has nursed a terrible estrangement from his mother and three siblings. After the 1988 death of his father and the rise of his career in Washington, DeLay cut off all contact with all three of his siblings, and 7 years ago he stopped attending DeLay family gatherings. He has not seen or talked to his mother, Maxine, in 2 years, even though she lives about 10 miles away from Sugar Land. Nor did he invite any of them to his daughter's 1999 wedding, or even mention his mother's existence in the published wedding announcement. All through his roomy home are many photographs of his wife, his daughter, and his in-laws, but not a single one of the DeLays, that is, his own natural family. Throughout our conversations, this rift is the only subject that he adamantly will not discuss. Too much bug killer for Mr. DeLay. His bug-killing company, by the way, now we go back and find out that his bug-killing company was also going down the tubes when he ran for the House of Representatives. A whole nother story, frankly not worthy of reporting in detail, so I won't. However, Jack Abramoff, a prominent lobbyist with ties to House Majority Leader Tom DeLay, might be taking DeLay down with him. Another DeLay alert, as it were, plus your calls. We'll get to all of that right after this. Tom Hartman here with you, 29 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
When the night has come and the land is dark and the moon is the only light we'll see.
Well, it's been like that the last few nights. we had such a bright full moon here a couple of nights ago. I don't know the phases of the moon right offhand, but it must have been a full moon or something close to it. It was so bright I had to get up and change the blinds because it was waking me up at 2 a.m. Anyhow, welcome back to our program. 26 and a half minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman limping around. I had to call up Rush and get some Vicodin or something. I threw my back up. Anyhow, You've heard talk show hosts say that before, haven't you? I've got a bad back. I know. I don't think it would improve the program. I really don't. So I'm not going to go there. Not going to go there. It's... Anyhow, what a day. What an interesting day we have here with Tom DeLay, Mr. Family Values, all sorts of fascinating insights into his life and into his world, and you know, and on it goes. And of course,
And now we find the liberals doing what they always do, and I've told you this. They always try to give me 50 milligrams of Vicodin instead of the 80s.
Ah, there you go. Yeah, there you go. All right. See? Anyhow, I've been packing books all weekend. It's Abramoff, a prominent lobbyist with ties to House Majority Leader Tom DeLay, created this foundation, the Capital Athletic Foundation. You'll recall Tom DeLay took this trip to Scotland, along with, on a private aircraft, golf trip, you know, a bunch of lobbyists, St. Andrews, Scotland. It's where the famous golf course is located. You recall all that? And it's kind of coming back to bite him. It's one of his ethics things. Well, here, the Honorable Charles Grassley, the Honorable Max Backus, this letter sent to them from Rick Cohen, executive director of the National Committee for Responsive Philanthropy. He says, what about this group that Abramoff has put together, this guy who's good buddies with Tom DeLay? It's called the Capital Athletic Foundation, a 501c3, a nonprofit. They say the foundation spent as little as 1% of some $6 million in charitable funds for sports-related program for needy youth, the specific purpose of the foundation. They raised $6 million. They spent 1% of that. Let's see, 10% would be $600,000. 1% would be $60,000. So they raised $6 million. They spent $60,000 to help youth with sports. What happened to the other $5,940,000? Well, instead of supporting sports-related programs, the foundation diverted funds to private aircraft and golf trips for lobbyists to St. Andrews in Scotland. Very interesting. And on it goes. And now we discover also Robert Schindler, Terry Schiavo's father, pulled the plug on his mother. This, at the very end, oddly, of an article in The Guardian today. Well, it wasn't today, actually. Geez, this article was a year ago, November 4th, 2003, in The Guardian. Of course, it was 2 years ago. This was the last time that this story was, you know, hot. But given the vehemence with which he is fighting to prolong Terry's life, it is a little surprising to learn that Robert Schindler, Terry Schiavo's father, decided to turn off the life support system for his mother. She was 79 at the time. She'd been ill with pneumonia for a week when her kidneys gave out. He says, and I quote, "I can remember like yesterday, the doctors said she had a good life. I asked, if you put her on a ventilator, does she have a chance of surviving or coming out of this thing? Robert says, I was very angry with God because I didn't want to make those decisions." Which leads the psychotherapist in me to wonder if he's just acting out some guilt about that. I mean, who knows? I don't want to psychoanalyze the guy. I don't know him. It's unethical. State of Vermont might bounce me off the roster. 1-866-889-8894 is our telephone number, toll free across the United States. TomHartman.com. If you want to drop into the live chat room, Austin in North Carolina on the line. Hey, Austin, how you doing? What's up?
Oh, I'm doing great. Thank you very much. My comment was that I think it's activist legislators that are trying to run roughshod over the judicial.
But isn't the job of a legislator to be an activist? I mean, aren't they supposed to be active on our behalf?
Well, they're supposed to be activists, but then on the other hand, it's the job of the judicial branch to make sure they don't go too far. And I think that's the problem. They've gone way too far in trying to legislate morality and moral values and they've just gone way too far.
Yeah, to some extent, just for purposes of clarity, though, just so we all understand, I think that it's very easy to confuse the two different functions of the judicial branch. Prior to 1803, that is, for the first 20 years of this country's history, there was really only one function of the judicial branch, and that was to settle arguments based on what the law said. So, you know, if Terry Schiavo's parents said, keep her alive, and her husband said, pull the plug, the court would look at the law and they'd say, okay, this is the law. In 1803, Justice John Marshall, who was the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, the first cousin of Thomas Jefferson, and political enemy of Thomas Jefferson, he was a Federalist, he was appointed to that job as one of John Adams' last things that he did as he was leaving office in 1800, and as a gift to Thomas Jefferson. That's how much he hated Jefferson. In 1803, in a famous Supreme Court case called Marbury versus Madison, it involved James Madison, Chief Justice Marshall ruled that the Supreme Court had the right to declare a law unconstitutional. Prior to that, the Supreme Court did not have that right. It's not written in the Constitution. And ever since then, there has been a second job that the judiciary can do, and it's generally only done by the federal courts, although it's also done, state Supreme Courts now do it in interpreting state constitutions, and sometimes state appeals courts, and federal appeals courts and the Supreme Court do it with regard to the federal constitution, and that is to say, not to say, okay, we're going to decide who's right and who's wrong in this argument, but rather, we're going to decide whether a law passed by the legislature violates or does not violate the Constitution of the United States. And those are two separate functions, and it's important that we keep them separate. If the legislature goes too far, if they get too activist, and they pass a law that violates the Constitution, the Constitution, for example, says no law shall be passed abridging freedom of speech, and so somebody passes a law that says that, you know, you can't say a certain thing or you go to jail, then, you know, the courts can step in and say, hey, they've gone too far. On the other hand, there's a lot of things the Constitution doesn't talk about. Can you pass a law saying that, you know, when you have to stop for a red light? Not in the Constitution, but it's a law. I mean, we all agree on it. So this is two points. Austin, I hope I didn't take you too far off into left field there, but I think it's an important one that people realize that there's really two functions to the judiciary here in the United States.
Right, and personally, I'm glad they did declare laws unconstitutional from time to time.
Well, it's been a mixed bag because in some ways they have, like, for example, in 1873 in Bradwell versus State, they ruled that women didn't have rights under the Constitution. In 1896 in Plessy versus Ferguson, they ruled that blacks didn't have rights under the Constitution. And, you know, so in 1854 in Dred Scott, they ruled that slavery was legal. And so in those cases, you could argue that the Supreme Court was. Those were activist decisions, you could say, that they were saying that they were essentially making law. And so, you know, it's been a mixed bag. We've had good decisions and bad decisions through the years.
Well, I certainly agree with that. But I think that the way the Congress is trying to push their way into people's private lives and make what was essentially a family decision into a public spectacle. I just don't agree with that. I mean, I had to agree with my family to pull the plug on my dad 15 years ago, and I know that's what he would have wanted to do.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's what we did. And I don't have any regrets about it at all because I know in my heart we did the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't need somebody in Congress telling me what to do.
Yeah, and I think that the vast majority of Americans are looking at this hysterical get-together that Tom DeLay and George Bush organized.
Oh, it was a circus.
Yeah, and saying the exact same thing that you're saying. You know, if it's the end of my life, I really don't want Tom DeLay deciding if I'm going to live, you know, in another 15 years in pain or in unconsciousness. Frankly, I'd rather he had nothing to do with the process.
Absolutely, and I wouldn't want to live that way either.
Yeah, yeah. Austin,
okay.
Thanks for the
call.
I appreciate it.
Call.
Sure enough. Yeah, good point that you made, and I appreciate it. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Harriet in Seattle, Washington on the line. Hey, Harriet, what's up?
Good morning, Tom.
Hey, Seattle, Harriet, what's up?
Yeah, right. Did you see both Newt Gingrich and Lieberman this weekend and their comments?
I saw Lieberman on, what was it, Meet the Press? I missed Newt. In fact, if I'd known he was on, I would have gone out of my way to turn the TV
off. Unfortunately, I didn't have the opportunity. It went fast enough with the remote. He was basically saying, and I agree with your comment on activist judges, but he was saying that the Republicans are going to suffer basically no damage from this whole situation, that the two things that are going to come out of it is that a move against activist judges, in other words, those who enforce the law, and secularism.
Yeah, see, he's making the point that I was making earlier, which is that the real strategy, these guys are playing chess, not checkers.
Right.
And everybody's interpreting it like checkers, like it's like they're trying to save Terry Schiavo's life.
Right.
This is not about saving Terry Schiavo's life. This is about convincing people that the judiciary system is broken so that Jeb Bush can throw his hands up in the air and George Bush can throw his hands up in the air and say, look at this, the courts are out of control. We can't even save a person's life. And so that when they put these extremist right-wing cranks up to for the Supreme Court, there will not be as much opposition. That's what it's about. And if Newt Gingrich was saying that, he's right. And as much as I'm loath to say so, I agree with my former congressman in that regard.
He is, but the other issue, too, is the secularism. It's part of the push toward theocracy.
Absolutely.
They think it's going to push toward theocracy.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And, you know, Lieberman, it wasn't his Meet the Press one. It was just kind of a passing interview, or he said, of course the government has a right to be in our lives, you know, to decide about when life begins and when it ends.
Yeah.
And most of us kind of fit somewhere in the middle.
I was quite astounded, actually, on whatever the morning show is with Tim Russert. I think it's Meet the Press.
Meet the Press,
They had a round table, and they had several people on there. And one of them was, well, several of them actually were making comments that were just so absolutely wrong about the founding of this country. I mean, Jefferson pointed out over and over and over again that common law, British common law, on which American common law was founded and on which the Constitution in large part was based, the British common law existed 200 years before Christianity came to England.
Yes.
And therefore was not founded in Christianity.
Right.
And John Adams agreed with him. And they both wrote about it extensively. And yet they had virtually all these guys on the left and on the right saying, oh, no, Islamic countries are based on Islamic. They draw their morality from Islam. Confucianist countries draw their morality from Confucianism. Hindu countries draw their morality from Hinduism. And America draws its morality from Judeo-Christian ethics. Now, I'm sorry. I agree with Thomas Jefferson. He said we didn't need to look in dusty manuscripts to find these things. They were written in our hearts. Everybody understands it's wrong to kill, it's wrong to steal. The First Amendment, thou shalt have a commandment, thou shalt have no gods before me. That's, I mean, you know, where does that fit into American law? That's, that, you know, this is where you start getting into theology and theocracy. But the two commandments, which are part of our common law, are parts of the common law of tribes in the Amazon.
Yes, yes, exactly. It's common sense.
That's right. That's right. It's just
common
morality. Harriet, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Let's see, 17 minutes before the hour, 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Rick in Grand Rapids, Michigan on the line. Hey, Rick, welcome to the program.
Yes. How's the weather there today?
It's gray and rainy.
Well, believe it or not, here in Grand Rapids, Michigan, it's going to be in the 50s and sunny, and tomorrow 60 and sunny. So we're having great
marvelous
weather.
Hopefully it's headed our way. It usually
I hope
is.
So. Yeah. But I wanted to talk about the Terry Schiavo case?
Yes, sir.
I'm a liberal Democrat, and I'm disagreeing with most of my colleagues in that area. I mean, people like Al Franken and Barney Frank, whom I usually agree with, I find them to be extremely callous in this regard. And I think if the parents are willing to take on the expense of caring for this woman, and I was not aware of the story about him pulling the plug on his mother, but whether he feels guilty or not, you know, past sins don't mean you have to continue to do them. And I just feel that in the area of life, and, you know, my sister even asked me this. She says, well, how can you be a liberal and be pro-life? I says, I think that's very liberal to take care of unborn babies or people in the latter stages of life. I mean, it's funny how liberals, and this just gives food to the conservatives when they say, well, how come you liberals want to protect whales and you don't want to protect babies or people that are brain damaged? And I agree with that. I think if you want to be consistently liberal and pro-life, you should be for life, whether it's animals.
Rick,
people.
Up until 3 days ago, I was saying the same thing. I was saying, listen, if you've got two groups in the family, and one group says, hey, we'll take care of her, and the other group says, no, you know, we don't
sure.
want to, that why not just give her to the group that wants to take care
sure.
of her? Then I learned more about the case. Then I learned that for 5 years, Michael Schiavo was living with Terry's parents, that she went back and forth between nursing homes and the parents' house. The parents couldn't deal with her. They put her up. He flew her out to California. They tried all these special therapies. That finally, 4 or 5 years ago, they did a CAT scan on her where they discovered that most of her brain has actually turned to liquid. It has been replaced by spinal fluid. And in court, not only did her husband testify, there had been two cases in her family within 5 years prior to the time that she went into a coma 15 years ago, two cases where people had been on machines and they had had to pull the plug. And not only did her husband testify, but her friends testified that she had said, in the context of those two cases, if I'm ever in that situation, don't let me live. And the law is quite clear that the husband who knows her as an adult, I mean, parents know her as a child, the husband who knows her as an adult is probably the best arbiter of her wishes. I would rather have my wife, who knows me now, say, pull the plug, than my parents say, keep me alive, you know, like a petrified pet. Sorry, Rick.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, small...
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Speaking of hearing the rumbling, big earthquake, underwater earthquake just off the coast of Indonesia just now. Hopefully it will not produce another killer tsunami, but this time at least they're getting the warnings out. A good thing. I guess the main point, Rick, that we got caught by the break there, but just to wrap up, the main point that I want to make is that the law which we collectively, we the people, passed, is that in the absence of a living will, the way that the wishes of a person who can't communicate and is only being kept alive by medical intervention, the way that those wishes are communicated, if they haven't written something down in advance, is number one, through their spouse if they are married. If that person's not available, then it would be their parents. If they're not available, then it would be their siblings. There's a hierarchy here. That's simply the law. And I think it's an appropriate law. I think that even though my parents raised me until I was 16, 17 years old, my wife, who I've lived with for 33 years now, knows better what I want. I have a 31, 32-year-old daughter. I suspect, you know, I remember her as a child. I knew her as a child. But I suspect that her husband, to whom she's been married for 7, 8 years now, it hasn't been that long, but been living with that long, I suspect that he knows her wishes better than I do as an adult. And I think that we need to honor those. And besides that, that's the law. Judy in Michigan on the line. Hey, Judy, what's on your mind?
Yes, and we're talking about Terry Schiavo again. I feel sorry for her.
I do, too.
God says, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not take a life. But under this on the circumstances and the condition she is, I think he would be very loving and very understanding. Because if he intended on her to stay here, maybe it's time for her to go to be with him.
Maybe he would have given her the ability to swallow.
Right, and he would have restored her mind.
Yeah.
Her brain.
Yeah, that's my point. If you want to throw this into the realm of theology.
Tom, what they're getting ready to do with us people on Social Security, I got a son that's 43, and so I'm a senior. And next year, Bush and the Congress is really going to stick it to us seniors and anybody that's on disability, that's on Social Security, because I got a letter in the mail from Medicare, and as of the 1st of 2006, they're going to charge us $35 a month.
I got it, Judy. And in fact, I was going to talk about that in the next hour. The Medicare and the Medicare copayments are going up. The doctor fees are going up. This is all part of the Bush plan to get rid of what they call socialism. They just don't think that we should be supporting people in America, particularly with money taken from wealthy taxpayers. And that's the bottom line, unfortunately. Anyhow, it's a tragedy. It really is, this Terry Schiavo thing. It's the radio support group of, by, and for We the People. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live coast to coast, border to border, and streaming around the planet as well. In fact, if you drop into our chat room, there's people in there from at least two continents I know of. And we're getting updates on what's going on in Asia, by the way. The possibility of a tsunami, an 8.5 earthquake off the coast of Sumatra. Keep you up to date. Medicare benefits are likely to see double-digit increases in the premiums they pay for physician visits and other outpatient care. This from today's Wall Street Journal. The Bush administration announced that premiums for Medicare's Part B are projected to rise 12% this year. This next year. This year, they went up 17%. So elderly on Medicare are paying more for their doctor visits and other outpatient care. At the same time, of course, Bush wants to take apart Social Security. But even setting that aside, at the same time now, they want to say, okay, and if you can't afford this, if you can't afford your medical treatment, if you can't afford your medical bills, and you have to declare bankruptcy, which is the reason why more than half of Americans who declare bankruptcy do so, we're going to make it even harder for you to declare bankruptcy. Go figure. I wanted to get David Swanson on this. David is involved. He's on the board of Progressive Democrats of America.com, or Progressive Democrats of America, which is what, PDDemocrats.org?
PDAmerica.org.
PDAmerica.org. Thank you, David. You got to keep me on clear on that all the time. And, of course, DavidSwanson.org. The bankruptcy bill is out of the Senate, and my understanding is that it's going to be sometime next week that it's going to show up in the House. Is that the case?
Yeah, it's already passed the House Judiciary Committee, and it's expected to come to a vote in the full House within the next 2 weeks. And I've got a new one for you, debtslavery.org.
Yes.
Debtslavery.org has all the information on this bill.
Yeah, in fact, I have a printout from that homepage, Debt Slavery, D-E-B-T, slavery.org. And by the way, there's a if you have anything to do with that website, there's an ad on that site that has a dead link on it. But in any case, it's a great site. I have an email here, and maybe you can help me understand this, David. This from a woman by the name of Liz in Philadelphia, and Liz is... not a personal friend or anything, but somebody that I know and know of. And Liz has some money, and she, is a supporter of. I don't want to say she's like high roller rich like the Scapes or anything, but she gets invited to these major donor fundraiser kinds of things. And she says on Monday, March 7th, Debbie Stabenow, this is the United States Senator from Michigan. Who, by the way, and I want to preface all this by saying Debbie Stabenow is going to be up for re-election in 2006, and I think the Democrats of Michigan need to do everything they can to get her re-elected because the Republicans have targeted her. They're going to try and take her down and replace her with a Republican, and that's going to further solidify Republican control of the Senate, and that'll be a disaster for both Michigan and America. So to whatever extent this may be perceived as a criticism of Debbie Stabenow, let me frame it in the context of I am supportive of her candidacy and of her as a senator, and I think, by and large, she's been a very good senator for the state of Michigan and continues to be. So I really want to focus on this one issue, but this is a framing. I think that this is the question I have for you, David.
Yeah.
Let me just share with you Liz's letter. She says, on Monday, March 7th, Debbie Stabenow stood in front of a room full of high donors in Philadelphia, myself among them, and talked about what an abomination the bankruptcy bill was. The occasion was a fundraiser for Stabenow and Senator Maria Cantwell. Tom Daschle was a guest speaker. Senator Stabenow railed against the Republicans and lambasted them for voting down Senator Durbin's amendment to exempt service members from the bankruptcy bill's means test. Senator Kennedy's amendment to exempt families whose bankruptcies are due to medical crises from means testing, Senator Schumer's amendment to close the Asset Protection Trust loophole, Senator Dayton's amendment to cap credit card interest at 30%, and Senator Nelson's amendment to exempt debtors from means testing if their financial problems are caused by identity theft. In other words, all of these proposals were put forth. All of them got shot down. Debbie Stabenow stood up in front of this group and said, it's horrible that these amendments got shot down. I agree with her, as does Liz. Liz says, now this is Monday, March 7th. On Tuesday, March 8th, Liz says, Senator Stabenow voted for cloture. On Wednesday, she voted for the bill. She voted for the bill without any of the amendments whose rejection by the Republicans she deplored. I was stunned. The letter you read from Senator Stabenow's office mentioned balance between consumer protection and personal responsibility. Really? How did she weigh the protection of service members, the ill, the elderly, and those whose identities have been subject to theft, on whose behalf she spoke with such passion on Monday, and who are left utterly unprotected by this bill? And then Liz goes on to say, I'd love to be able to tell you she's in the pocket of MBNA, but I've checked her contributors for 2004 at OpenSecrets.org, and I'm just not seeing it. Biggest contributor by far is Emily's list. So I'm mystified. But this is a large part of the problem with the Democratic Party. You can't talk populism on Monday, vote corporatism on Tuesday, and expect anyone to trust you on Wednesday. What has happened, in your opinion? I mean, you're on the inside in Washington there to some extent, to a fairly large extent, David. And you know what's going on. What's with these Democrats who supported this bankruptcy bill in the Senate? And what's going to happen when it comes before the House?
Well, there are 19 Democratic senators who voted for the credit card companies on this. And, you know, the extent of hypocrisy was extreme among many of them. Many of them made similar speeches. You even have Senator Lieberman, who voted for cloture, which was the vote that counted, that cuts off debate and moves the thing to passage, and then voted against the bill in order to brag that he had voted against it.
So trying to have it both ways.
He wants to have it every which way, yeah. And, you know, if you look at the funding, the senators who voted for it got significantly more from the credit card and financial industry than those who voted against, at least on average. And the Democrats who voted for it got significantly more than the Republicans. The Republicans are considered safer. They don't need as much bribery. But if you look, as your friend did, at where else are these senators getting money? Many of them are getting more money from labor than they're getting from credit card companies. Yet they're voting against working people. They're voting for the credit card companies.
So why would they do this? I mean, we have at least a dozen listeners to this program have gotten letters. Actually, I've gotten them from senators from New Mexico, in California. I mean, all over the country, we have listeners who have been calling in and saying, okay, here's the letter I got from my senator about why they voted on it. Not from California, because Boxer and Feinstein didn't vote for it, but the various states where Democrats did vote for it. And it's almost like they're all from the same form letter. I mean, there's variations, but they all say, you know, we needed to reform this. There were abuses, and we put in protections and blah, blah, blah. And I read Senator Stabenow's letter on the air so that, her position would be on the record here. And, you know, it sounds like she, if she believes what she wrote in the letter, it sounds like she's trying to do the right thing. What happened?
Well, there are a number of possible reasons, and one is that this bill is in the interest not just of the credit card companies, but of all of corporate America, that it's not just the credit card companies as contributors and supporters and lobbyists. It's all of corporate America.
Like the big retail chains that are now offering their own credit cards, for example. So Target, which gives most of its money to Republicans, would be in favor of this because they issue a credit card.
Right, but also any other major corporation that fears it may end up like Kmart or Enron and face bankruptcy. This bill does everything possible to help not just wealthy individuals, but corporations. This does nothing to clean up bankruptcies by businesses. And one of the many amendments that was voted down was one to protect workers' shares and retirement in companies that go bankrupt, and that was thrown out. You know, in addition, you know, it's not just campaign contributions tallied up. It's also all the lobby visits, all the pressure, all the possibilities of future careers after Congress, all of the, vacation junkets and speaking fees. There's there's a lot that goes with pleasing corporate America beyond just the campaign contributions from just the credit card companies.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's, as always, there's a huge team of skilled lobbyists on one side, and then there's sort of the general public out there vaguely on the other side. And this is an issue that sort of falls between a lot of groups. It's not really a housing issue. It's not at the top of the list of the civil rights organizations. It's not at the top of the list of the labor organizations.
But it is at the top of the list for corporate America. That's the bottom line. I contacted Senator Jeffords' office. He's one of my two senators, Jeffords and Leahy, and he voted for it. He's the only independent in the Senate, and he voted for it. And I said, why? In fact, I talked to the guy in his office who actually is responsible for, you know, these kinds of issues, a guy by the name of Eric. And Eric gave me all these kind of what I consider to be rather weak excuses. And when I challenged him on them, he got a little testy with me. And I said, well, you know, ask the senator if he'd like to come on the air and talk with us about this. And that was the last I heard. And, you know, and I would,
yeah, I bet it will be.
And I would love to have Debbie Stabenow come on and explain, you know, why this vote. Or many of the other senators. There was a senator from New Mexico whose name is escaping me at the moment who voted in favor of this thing. And I've got, you know, several people.
Bingaman.
Bingaman. There you go. And several people have forwarded letters to me from Senator Bingaman about why he voted for it. And, you know, but I'm not getting responses from these folks. Let's take a quick call here. Florence in Grand Rapids, Michigan on the line. Maybe Florence has some insights into this. Hey, Florence, you're on the line with David Swanson's on with us, davidswanson.org.
Right,
and Tom.
Right. I'm just calling to support what both of you are saying, but I think it's because they are DLC people.
The Democratic Leadership Council. These are the Republican light Democrats.
Right.
The Democrats who are in the pockets of the corporations.
And Hillary Clinton, you can include her in that.
Well, her husband
too.
Started it. Her husband, I mean, Bill Clinton was one of the founders of the DLC.
I know he was, and that's what I'm saying. You can include her in it, too.
But she did not vote for the bankruptcy bill.
No, I know she didn't, but
she didn't vote that way.
Go ahead, David. You said.
And I just think one way or the other.
She didn't vote one way or the other. So she
talk
took,
about
she
having
the,
it both ways.
She took the easy route.
There you have it, right there.
Yeah.
And Lieberman is a stench in the Democratic Party.
Oh yeah, Joe Lieberman and Zell Miller ought to start their own party. You know, the crank party.
Yeah, there's just no question about it. And I'm angry at Debbie Stabenow because she voted for Condi Rice. She voted for Gonzalez.
Yeah.
You know, she is a DLC person.
Well, and that may be true. And at the same time, I'll tell you, in 2006, when she's running against a Republican, the Republican's going to be a whole lot worse. And I hope you vote for her.
Well, I may have to vote for her, but I am so angry at her, and I've written many, many emails to her.
Yeah. Well, I think it's important that we try and resuscitate these DLC Democrats, bring them back from the edge. Florence, thanks for the call. I mean, we need to bring them back and bring them back into the fold. Don't you think, David? How do we best do this?
Well, we either bring them back or we challenge them in primaries with progressive candidates or use that as the way to do the former. I mean, there are 20 members of the House, Democratic members of the House, who sent a letter to the Speaker of the House, Hastert, supporting this bill.
Yeah, David. David, hold it right there. I want to pick up on the other side of the break here. We have to take a break though. We're talking with David Swanson. DavidSwanson.org. It's the Tom Hartman program. 20 minutes past the hour. 1-866-889-8894.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
I lived with them on Montague Street in a basement down the stairs. There was music in the cafes at night and revolution in the air.
Speaking of revolution in the air, Senate certainly didn't revolt against the bankruptcy bill. What will happen in the House? We've been talking with David Swanson, davidswanson.org, and pdamerica.org about this topic. And let's take just a brief break from that. I'm going to keep David on the line in the event he has something to toss into this. But Victoria Jones is with us for our daily report from the Talk Radio News Service from Washington, D.C. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, how are you?
I am great, but I'll get better. What's up? What's happening in Washington, D.C.? First of all,
yes.
Any bankruptcy news? Any bankruptcy bill news?
No.
Okay. All right. So what else is going on?
Well, that's partly why I feel like I'm here under false pretenses. I mean, it's raining. It's the day after Easter Sunday. Congress is out. The president's in, but doesn't seem to be doing anything. And nobody's doing anything. They even canceled the Easter egg roll.
Really? Why?
That was going to be my big news story for the day because of the rain.
Oh, okay.
In Washington, if it rains, you know, it all comes to a halt. And God forbid it should snow. They close the schools down if they think it's going to snow. And I'm not making that up.
Yeah.
So it's very quiet. But what people are thinking about is the polls that have been coming out in terms of Congress and the president's reaction to the Terri Schiavo case. And there are going to be holding hearings in Congress next week. I don't know which committee it is yet, on end-of-life issues. And I would expect that to be fairly contentious. And I think a lot of politicians are trying to regroup and figure out what their position is going to be now that they see their constituents, those of them who went out on a limb over this, don't necessarily agree with them.
Yeah, interesting. Interesting. So you think there's a price to be paid for this, Victoria?
I think there is a price to be paid for it. I think there's enough time between now and the midterm elections for them to recover from it. But, for example, Governor Jeb Bush, who says he's not running for president, he doesn't have any national ambitions, which nobody really believes, he's going to have to deal with this because he has one constituency that was very much on his side on this. And then he has another constituency of people who are fiscal Republicans but who do not support him on this. And it's interesting to me that both he and President Bush have stepped back and using very similar language are saying there's nothing that we can do.
Yeah.
And I can't help wondering whether they've been advised, back off now. Any other moves are going to look foolish.
Right, and blame it all on the judiciary so that when you bring the Supreme Court wackos forward, people will say, well, maybe we need some very conservative judges who will not try to make law and won't be activists and you know all the buzzwords that they've been throwing out, even though they're the opposite meaning of what's actually going on.
Well, and he may get more of a rebellion on this than he was doing. There were some Republicans who were likely to vote against him on some of these judges or who might have gone along for party unity. But if indeed the president puts forward more judges who are seen as very extreme, I think there will be some Republicans who are going to rebel because they've seen how the judiciary worked in this case, and it worked very sensibly and very well.
Yeah, yeah. At least in the minds of everybody except Randall Terry. Okay.
Well,
so,
does he have a mind?
Yeah. Well, let's not go there. Okay. All right, Victoria, thank you for your report from Washington, D.C.
We'll have lots. See you tomorrow.
Thank you. Okay, great. Have a great day. I appreciate it. Good
you too. Bye-bye.
Good to hear from you. Okay, David, back to you. This bankruptcy bill is going to the House of Representatives. Do you think that the Democrats in the House I think that the Democrats in the Senate had no idea that after they voted on this thing, anybody was going to pay any attention to it. And it's coming back to haunt them. People like Bingaman and Stabenow and whatnot, it's coming back to haunt them in a way that is making them very uncomfortable. And I have a feeling the House Democrats are noticing that. Do you think I'm right?
I think you're right, and I'm working to make sure you're right. And many activists and organizations are trying now to put some pressure on particularly Democrats, but anyone in the House who may be swayed on this. It's going to be close at best. But I think there really is a shot. And things are looking downhill for Bush and the Republicans. You know, the news has been all Terri Schiavo all the time. But even bankruptcy and Medicaid have made it into those stories. You know, families like Ms. Schiavo's are seeing cuts in health care spending and cuts
right.
in
she's
their
been She's
ability.
Been kept alive by Medicare. And if her family had to pay the legal bills, they would be bankrupt. And it's incredible. It's ironic. Okay, David Swanson, davidswanson.org, the website. Also, debtslavery.org, his new website. Check it out. Check it out and participate. Let your elected representatives know, Republican, Democrat, or independent, although I know where Bernie stands on this already. Let them know, no bankruptcy bill. Thank you very much. Dave, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom.
Good talking to you. 29 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program.
Ever wonder who...
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
I can hear the soft breathing of the girl that I love as she lies here beside me, asleep with the night. And I hail in a fine mist
floats on my pillow, reflecting the glow of the winter moonlight. But I've got to creep down the alleyway.
No, it's not a song about Michael Jackson. It just suffered a setback in court. That's a whole other thing. Now, I promise I am not going to be reporting on infotainment news. Medicare beneficiaries are likely to see double-digit increases in the premiums they pay. I want to get back to that in just a moment. First, however, Tom DeLay has been confronted, according to Andy Borowitz. This is from the Borowitz Report, borowitzreport.com. Andy Borowitz, in rare public appearance, God blasts Tom DeLay. Enough is enough, says the Almighty. In a rare public appearance, the leading theologians called extraordinary, God held a press conference in Washington on Sunday to disavow the recent words and deeds of House Majority Leader Tom DeLay of Texas. The normally reclusive ruler of the universe took the unusual step of speaking to reporters to blast Representative DeLay for repeatedly invoking his name in political fundraising appeals. The surprisingly outspoken Supreme Being said, I usually don't like to shoot my mouth off about every little thing that bugs me, but enough is enough. After complaining about Representative DeLay's unauthorized use of his name in fundraising pitches, God warned the Texas congressman to discontinue the practice at once or else. When asked if he intended to strike Representative DeLay with a lightning bolt, God replied with a terse, no comment, but later said, quote, I've been known to smite people in the past, and I'm not prepared to take smiting off the table, end quote. Hours after God's press conference concluded, a spokesman for Representative DeLay issued a one-sentence statement saying that the congressman and the Almighty remain on good terms and that he hoped to have God's support in 2006 midterm elections. But Dr. Hartland Minter of the University of Minnesota School of Divinity said the Representative DeLay would be well advised to heed God's words of warning. Said Reverend Minter, Dr. Minter, it means a lot that God took the trouble to hold a press conference, especially on his day off. That from Andy Borowitz, borowitzreport.com. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. I want to get back to Medicare and just say, first, let's talk to Klana in Wisconsin. Hey, Klana, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I just want to thank you how you put things out there in bits and pieces, and we are able to put it together for ourselves, what information we need to make our decisions. But I didn't call to compliment you there, but I will, because
okay. Well,
it's true.
You.
But I... Also, there's a legislator from Florida named Debbie Wasserman Schultz, or Congresswoman from Florida, and I heard her twice. I heard her speaking before Congress, and she was saying how, you know, that the Congress is not the place to make these decisions, and she went on about Terry Schiavo.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, judges. Are given the objective information to make an objective decision, and so therefore they should. And she said it yesterday on a morning, on a Sunday morning talk show also, and it just was such a clear, to the point and true her response to the questions that were being asked. I thought we should probably send little emails to her and say, thank you for being so straight and honest about this. I appreciate it.
Yeah, well done. What was her name again?
Debbie Wasserman Schultz.
I'm pretty sure I saw her on TV on one of those programs. Yeah, there are a lot of good people on. Frankly, I think that there are the majority of people in Congress on both sides of this issue
mm-hmm.
are taking positions that are positions of conscience, morality, belief. Legally appropriate, whatever. In my opinion, there's a small minority, perhaps as few as a dozen people, who are grandstanding this issue and trying to exploit it for political gain.
Well,
obviously,
I thought because she was from Florida too was important.
Yeah, sure. She's right in the middle of it. But I mean,
right.
Obviously, Bill Frist is trying to use this to further his presidential ambitions in 2008.
Yes.
Obviously, Tom DeLay is trying to use this to distract us from the problems that he's having and to maintain his political power. Obviously, Denny Hastert thought it was going to help him as Speaker of the House. And obviously, George Bush and Jeb Bush both thought that they could milk it for all it was worth to energize their base.
And she did say that. She said Congress does not make nonpartisan decisions. Their decisions are partisan.
They're supposed to be. That's the whole point of it.
They're partisan for their party.
That's right.
They're not for the people.
Well, and the parties are supposed to represent the people. I mean, that's why the people get together and organize into parties. But they
don't get the objective information. I guess maybe I'm not making myself clear, but they don't. She said it really well.
Yeah, well, I think her point, and I didn't hear her say this, but the way that I would say it is that while a judge's job is to interpret the law, right down the middle, without any personal bias and without any opinion, you know, with regard to whether the law is right or wrong, unless the law clearly contradicts the Constitution, which is that second area of judicial law that I was talking about earlier.
But they are presented with information too.
Right, but the judge's job is to make an objective decision. The Congress's job, our representatives and our senators, their job is to represent us. Their job is to have an opinion. But it's not to inflict that opinion upon us in the context of individual cases before the judiciary.
Mm-hmm.
It's to pass laws that represent the will of the majority of the people in ways that protect the rights of the minorities. That's the definition of a constitutionally limited democratic republic. And so, of course, we want our members of Congress to have an opinion, and we don't want them sticking their nose in our individual lives. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Tom.
Okay, thanks, Klana, for the call. Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. 1-866-889-8894. Jill in Allendale, Michigan, on the line. Hey, Jill, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Yeah, I was just wondering. I got on your show a little late today, and I didn't know if you'd heard that. On TV earlier this morning, I was watching news, and Tom DeLay had mentioned that the reason he had pulled the plug on his dad is that he was on a ventilator and Terry wasn't, and that was the difference. In his mind, that made a big difference, being on a ventilator. And I was thinking, my mom had been on a ventilator, and she lived to tell about it. So
yeah. And in fact, and this was a point that I made earlier, Terry Schiavo, because so much of her brain has dissolved, when they did the CAT scan and they looked inside her skull, mm-hmm. they discovered that most of her brain is actually now, there's an empty cavity there filled with spinal fluid.
Mm-hmm.
And so much of her brain is dissolved that she no longer has voluntary responses. She no longer has the ability to swallow. If you were to take a spoonful of baby food, of applesauce or something, put it in her mouth, she would not know how to swallow it. She would inhale it and she would choke. She would die. And so the only way that they can keep her alive, just like the only way they could keep Tom DeLay's father breathing was to shove a tube down his throat and pump air into his lungs.
Right.
The only way that they can keep Terry Schiavo alive is to drill a hole through her abdomen into her stomach and pump food into her stomach. It seems to me it's the same thing.
It sure does. It was just a quick comment, and I just thought I'd mention it, and I didn't understand that. Like I say, the first thing I thought of is my mother was on a ventilator herself, and to me that didn't really excuse the comparison there between his, you know, what he did with his father, and that was okay, but his opinion with her is totally different. He didn't want them to compare that to what he had done in the late 80s.
According to his 81-year-old mother, his father may or may not have survived without the ventilator. They didn't know, but he would have been a vegetable in either case. And so that's why they pulled the plug on him, was because he was going to be in a vegetative state. And she said that we all knew that he wouldn't have wanted to live like that, even though he left no living will. So there you go. Jill, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. And thanks for sharing that with us, because I didn't happen to see Congressman DeLay making the circuit this morning, but it's you know, people talk about their you know, Terry isn't being fed. If you fed Terry, she couldn't eat. I mean, this is, you know, as I said, I up until a few days ago, I was of the opinion, hey, give her to whoever's going to take care of her. If I was the judge, that would be the decision that I'd make. But the more I thought about it, and the more that I learned about the facts of this case, the more clear it became to me that, number one, this is a medical intervention, and number two, that we have to have laws. We have to have a hierarchy in our laws of who gets to make these decisions in the absence of something that's written down. And frankly, I would rather have my wife making these decisions for me than my parents. She knows me as an adult. She's, you know, of course, we've been married a long time, but I think even somebody who's been married, you know, 5-10 years, they probably know that person as an adult better than the parents know them as a child. And then, of course, you've got, you know, you compound this, and this is, in my opinion, the tragedy of it. The fact that Terry Schiavo's father made the decision to pull his own mother off life support. And then later said that he always felt guilty about that. And so, you know, maybe that helps to explain why he's so histrionic about this. In any case, moving along, here we have now Medicare. You want to talk about a true crisis. Everybody's running around going, oh, Social Security's going to go broke in 2042. Now it's 2041. So in 35 years, number one, it's not going to go broke. In 35 years, it's going to pay 70% of the benefits it's paying right now if we don't increase taxes or eliminate the cap. You simply eliminate the cap, you've solved the problem. I mean, it's very simple. But the Bush administration running around going, oh, Social Security, because really the agenda here is to privatize Social Security. The agenda is to do away with these so-called welfare programs, the so-called socialism that Republicans have opposed ever since Social Security was first passed in 1936 without a single Republican vote. This has always been their agenda. Well, you want a real crisis? Medicare. Now, there is a law that says that when Medicare's actuaries, the trustees of Medicare, the people who run Medicare, just like there's a board that runs Social Security, which unfortunately is headed by the Secretary of the Treasury, John Snow, right now. You know, it's like a semi-official, you know, whoever is the Treasury Secretary is the head of that board. But anyhow, if the board that runs Medicare projects that general fund revenues, that is, well, here's the sentence from the Wall Street Journal, and I'll explain it. General fund revenues fund more than 45% of total Medicare spending for 2 years in a row. In other words, what they're talking about right now with regard to Social Security is that 35 years from now, 40 years from now, 30% of the Social Security payments are going to have to come out of general fund taxes because the Social Security tax won't cover it. Okay? I mean, if they're going to continue making the payments, they're going to have to take them out of just regular income taxes. Now, Medicare has a law that says that if 2 years in a row, more than 45% of Medicare has to be paid for out of general fund taxes. In other words, Medicare is not only not collecting enough money to pay for itself, it's collecting so little money to pay for itself that 45% of it has to be paid for out of the general fund. If that happens, then the law requires Congress to hold a session and do something about it. And that they have to do that 5 years in advance. Now, the most recent trustees report, this is from Sarah Luck's article in today's Wall Street Journal, the most recent trustees report released last week said the 45% threshold would be reached for the first time in 2012. If projections hold, that means the trigger for action will occur in 2007. At that point, Sarah Luck writes, President Bush will be required to propose legislative changes and Congress would have to give them fast-track consideration. Can you imagine? The year before the presidential election, Bush is going to be forced with two choices. Raise Medicare taxes, cut Medicare benefits. Or third choice, some combination of the two. By law, what's he going to do? Now, my guess is what's going to happen is between now and 2007, Congress is going to get together and pass a law saying that you can ignore that law. So that whoever's president in 2009 will have to deal with it because they don't want it being dealt with in 2007 or 2008 during the presidential election. That's my projection. But assuming they don't do that, in the 2008 session, and November 2008 is the elections, Congress is going to have to deal with this. Robert Reischauer, president of the Urban Institute and former director of the Congressional Budget Office, says, one probably couldn't have written a worse timetable. Indeed. And you want to see a real crisis. Here we've got Medicare, being triggered in 2007. It's already on the edge of being broke. It will be broke, so broke that 45% of its payments are having to be made out of general income tax revenues in 2012, whereas Social Security won't hit that point until 2042, and it won't be 45%. It'll only be 20 to 30%. Amy in San Diego, California on the line. Hey, Amy, welcome to the program.
Oh, hi, Tom. I just wanted to talk a little bit about, you were talking earlier about the Terri Schiavo thing, and it really upsets me that this, the so-called Christian right people are getting involved in this, and I'm so afraid that they're going to change public opinion to get all of their activist judges in. And I wanted to
know... That's the agenda.
Yeah, I know. I know it is. And I was wondering, do you know, are there opposing Christian groups out there that are saying anything? Because
yeah, Barry Lind's group, Americans for Separation of Church and State. Barry Lind is a Protestant minister.
Oh, okay.
The Catholic Church, you know, the Catholic hospitals have had policies on this for several decades now that they will withdraw life support. So, regardless of what the Vatican newspaper, it was not the Pope, it was the Vatican newspaper, said about Terri Schiavo, the official policy of Catholic hospitals in the United States is to withdraw care when people are in persistent vegetative states. And so, you know, there are Christians on the other side of this, but they're not standing up and waving
right,
their Christianity.
Right, we're not standing up. So I want to get in touch with
Well, Barry Lind's,
that you mentioned,
you know,
yeah.
Americans for Separation of Church and State, if you just plug that into Google, you'll find it. It should be very easy to find. Barry Lind is the director. He has a radio program. He does a lot of shows. They publish a lot of good stuff. He's out there. He's a good guy.
Okay, I'll check it out. Thanks, Tom.
Thanks, Amy. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. 10 minutes before the hour, the Tom Hartman program, where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? For that matter, is Tom DeLay a person?
Attention, Tom Hartman listeners. I'm here with Brush Lintball.
This is the old Brusho, Brush Lintball.
To tell you about Democratic Men.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. 4.5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. You ever hear of the Zanon factory? It's a factory in Argentina, and it's part of an extraordinary social experiment and increasingly a movement around the world. And this is absolutely fascinating. Argentina, of course, privatized Social Security about 15 years ago, and when they privatized Social Security, They had to borrow massively in order to do it. I mean, it was a scheme very similar to what George W. Bush has sort of proposed. I mean, he hasn't laid a proposal on the table, but what people say he's proposing. And the stock market went in the tank worldwide. The Argentinian currency dropped a little bit. And the result was all of a sudden the country was bankrupt. They couldn't make payments on their own debt because they privatized Social Security. It threw Argentina into bankruptcy. And I was down in Argentina about 5-6 years ago, something like that. And they're still recovering from it. You still have, you know, middle class neighborhoods, people selling their TV sets and their furniture to try and buy food. And so the result of this was just widespread unemployment, wiped out the country's economic base, small companies going bankrupt left and right. And so all over Argentina, as businesses went under and factories were empty, the workers in the factories said, well, hey, you know, maybe the management has gone away. Maybe they've declared bankruptcy. Maybe they've taken their millions and fled to Spain or whatever. We're going to continue running this factory. And they created this movement of worker-run factories. The Zanon factory is one that makes ceramic tiles. And they run them as a collective, sort of, as a democracy, actually. Every single one of the workers, there's now 200 of these democratic workplaces, 15,000 workers. And every single person in the company votes. And so they all voted that everyone would make the exact same salary. One worker, one vote. Everybody would have the exact same salary, whether they were the janitor, whether they were the salesperson. They have increased their workforce from 300 to 450, a 50% increase. And this, you know, as the country is sinking into a hole, they strengthened the local community. They voted to create a health clinic for the local community that they're in. And did it. Took them only 3 months to build a brand new health facility. And now the former owner of the factory, who had declared bankruptcy and walked away, is saying, hey, I want this thing back. And the government is saying, okay, well, I guess you own it. and it's making money now, so you can have it back, and so the police are going to move in and take out the workers. It's getting weird down there in Argentina. Keep your eye on it. Naomi Klein just wrote a great piece about it. PetitionOnline.com/Zanin/petition.htm, the website. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends, to your light at the end of the tunnel of talk radio. Tom Hartman here in the no boring zone. Welcome back to the third hour, the best hour, well, the best third hour of our program. Former President Jimmy Carter is going to lead a bipartisan commission to examine. This is one of those good news, bad news stories, okay? Here's the good news. The good news, former President Jimmy Carter will lead a bipartisan commission to examine problems with the U.S. election system, America's University Center for Democracy and Election Management said on Thursday. So the good news, according to Reuters, former President Jimmy Carter, a man whose integrity is generally considered unimpeachable. He didn't leave office and go hook up with the Carlyle Group and make hundreds of millions for his family fortune and his trust fund grandchildren. Instead, he did good stuff. Former President Jimmy Carter is going to be on a commission to look into the possibility that elections in the United States are being stolen by electronic voting machines, by rigging of elections, by, as Catherine Harris did in Florida, knocking 70,000 African Americans off the voting rolls just a month before the election, as was done in Ohio by telling people that they are supposed to vote in different areas, and then when they show up, telling them that they can't vote there, and Democrats, of course, and so on and so forth. That's the good news. Here's the bad news. You will recall in 2000, down in Florida, the big battle that was held down in Florida in the year 2000, where all those people showed up banging on the windows saying, stop the count, stop the count. Turned out that those folks were all employees of Tom DeLay's who had been flown down, who had been specifically flown down for that purpose. You know, in fact, you could identify in the individual members of Tom DeLay's staff. And the guy who put this whole thing together, who organized essentially the theft of the vote in 2000 in Florida, was Jim Baker, you'll recall, the former consigliere to the Bush family, particularly Bush Sr. Well, Jimmy Carter's partner in this commission is going to be, guess who, Republican James Baker. Tom Daschle is also going to participate in this thing. We have no idea what participate means. Maybe he'll hold the door for Baker as he comes. Who knows? More to come on that story as it develops. Keep your eye on it. I think it's going to be an interesting one. Time will tell. Time for our environmental alert. Stephen Johnson, Bush's nominee to run the EPA. Yeah, the guy that George Bush said, we should put this guy in charge of the Environmental Protection Agency. Stephen Johnson, this from Intervention Magazine. Stephen Johnson advocates the testing of pesticides on humans, even children, for the benefit of large chemical companies. Mr. Johnson, Intervention Magazine notes in an article by Gene C. Girard. Mr. Johnson has been the acting administrator of the EPA since January. Prior to that, he oversaw the EPA office handling pesticides and other toxic substances. Bush calls him a talented scientist. Now, why would that be? Well, during President Clinton's administration, the EPA would not consider the results of controversial trials that tested pesticides on people. After all, they considered it immoral to give children pesticides that 20, 30 years later might give them cancer. But after Mr. Bush was elected, Stephen Johnson changed the rules so the pesticides could be tried out on people. A panel of scientists and ethicists convened by the EPA in 1998 determined that these types of trials were unethical and scientifically unsuitable to estimate the safety of chemicals. They're unethical because, number one, because they're being done on humans, and especially those tests being done on children. And they're bad science because they run six-month toxicity tests, one-year toxicity tests, in some cases one-month toxicity tests to decide whether or not to put a chemical on the market. When we know from past experience, many of these chemicals have 10, 15, 20-year consequences. It would be much better, frankly, to do the tests if on tissue samples, on tissue in vitro, or if you want to, if you're into vivisection, on lab rats, where at least you can see what happens over five generations in the course of a year or two. But no, Stephen Johnson said, let's give them to people. So in 2001, the trials considered by the EPA gave paid subjects doses of pesticides 100 to 300 times greater than levels that the EPA says are safe for the general public. The EPA evaluated three studies that year, one from Dow Chemical, one from the Gowan Corporation, and one from Bayer Corporation. Bayer, by the way, the German combine, the German corporation that was involved in tests done on citizens and civilians held in German concentration camps. Bayer, one of the companies that was involved in employing Dr. Mengele. The EPA, obviously, they've reformed themselves since then, let us hope. The Bayer, or Bayer as we say in America, and Gowan studies were conducted in third world countries where volunteers are more readily available. But Dow Chemical, they conducted their study in Nebraska. In October of last year, Johnson strongly supported a study in which infants will be monitored for health impacts as they undergo exposure to known toxic chemicals for a two-year period. The participants will be selected from six health clinics and three hospitals in Duval County. This a county where 75% of the users of the clinics for pregnancy issues are at or below the poverty level.
Let's test these things on poor people. Yes, that sounds like a great idea, Doctor. Let's find some poor people and give them some pesticides.
Well, that's what they're doing. The EPA has targeted this, Intervention Magazine writes, the EPA is targeting the poor and African Americans for the study, presumably in the hope that they will be less informed about the dangers of exposing their children to pesticides and will therefore continue to expose them over the two-year period. The study actually mandates that participants not be told, not be provided information about the proper ways to apply or store pesticides around the home. And the parents cannot be informed of the risks of prolonged or excessive exposure to pesticides. Additionally, the study does not provide steps to intervene if the children show signs of developmental delay or register high levels of exposure to pesticides in the periodic testing. I would add, if this is Duval County, they're talking about Florida, 75% of the users are below poverty level. Most of them are probably also black. Does the Tuskegee experiments echo for anybody? Now, how much are they going to pay these poor parents? By poor, I mean, well, in both senses of the term. If they expose their children to pesticides continuously for two full years without being informed of the dangers and without being provided any intervention if the children show developmental delays or register high levels of exposures, how much will Dow Chemical or have to pay these parents? $970 for the full 2 years. This is the CHEERS program. CHEERS. This is incredible. CHEERS. I'm trying to find where this acronym came from. I don't have the. It's apparently not in this article. Oh, here it is, right here. Children's Environmental Exposure Research Study. Children's Environmental Exposure Research Study, known as CHEERS. Now, where did the EPA get the money? I'm sorry, it's not Dow Chemical who's going to pay them $970. It's the EPA. Where did the EPA get the money to pay $970 each to families of poor black children and not inform them over the dangers of exposing their children to 2 years of pesticides? Well, it turns out the American Chemistry Council gave $2.1 million to the EPA to fund CHEERS. Who makes up the American Chemistry Council? Manufacturers of pesticides. And the guy who's the big advocate for this, the guy who when Bush came into office, said, hey, let's start doing this. Clinton made it illegal. He thought it was unethical. Wuss. Let's start doing this. Stephen Johnson. And who is it now that Bush has nominated to run the Environmental Protection Agency? Stephen Johnson. Yes, my friends, your interests being carefully watched for, the safety of our children being carefully monitored, the safety of America, you are safe from the predations of the big pesticide companies. Now it's the EPA doing it for them under Stephen Johnson and the Bush administration. Welcome to the wonders of Bush World 2005. Remarkable. And other environmental news. I got a story here about honeybees. We've got some interesting news about Alaska, BP, and the energy bill. Unlikely allies are organizing to fight U.S. oil dependence. An interesting piece in today's Wall Street Journal. Lots of fascinating stuff to talk about this hour. First, let's take a call. Alice in Humboldt County is on the line. 1-866-889-8894, our toll-free number. Hey, Alice, welcome to the program.
Yeah, good morning, Tom. They are now running a commercial at Alice. One, have you heard of a solution from the Democrats to the Social Security crisis that followed by a clock ticking?
Right.
I wonder if we are paying for that commercial.
Well, it's hard to say, Alice. I believe that that particular commercial is funded by a group that's funded by the financial services industry that will make billions off the privatization of Social Security. What that commercial also isn't telling you is that the Republicans have not yet put forward any proposals for fixing Social Security either. Both the Democrats and the Republicans are waiting for the other side to speak first because they know whoever puts forth the suggestion, because the suggestion will have to involve either raising taxes or cutting benefits, is going to get shot down by the other side. And so the Republicans are playing chicken with the Democrats, and then they're running an ad saying the Democrats aren't offering any proposals. The Republicans have not offered any proposals. Bush is talking about privatization as an important part of it, but privatization will not solve the problem of the lack of money in Social Security. In fact, it'll make it worse. So, Alice, you're pointing it out absolutely right. And you got to be sure and turn down the radio next time you call in, because that five-second delay will make you completely disoriented. Alice, I appreciate the call. It's good to hear from you.
Well, and I appreciate your work.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And keep spreading the good word there in Humboldt County. It's always marvelous to hear from you. Humboldt County, one of the fine places on God's earth here out there on the West Coast. Could it be that we could run out of food because the mites have grown immune to our chemicals? Maybe this is why Stephen Johnson wants to start testing pesticides on children. You think that's a stretch? Maybe not. I'll tell you about it right after this. 20 minutes after the hour, I'm Tom Hartman. This is the True People's Radio.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. There's a tsunami coming. Small tsunami in the Cocos Islands, by the way, just so you know. Apparently, so far, no major destruction, no big disasters. But the earthquake has been upgraded to 8.7. So we'll see. Of course, tsunamis are not just the magnitude of the quake, but how the Earth moves and where it moves. And, you know, there's all kinds of variables involved in these things. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. By the way, Rama tells me that the website for the Cheers program, can you imagine, I mean, you know, we were talking about this during the break. Rama says, I'd love to have a job, thinking up these acronyms. I mean, because, you know, obviously they're not going to call this thing the Children's Exposure to DDT Project. So they call it CHEERS, Children's Environmental Exposure Research Study. It's like, who comes up with these? Right? It's got to be pre-approved by Frank Luntz, I'll tell you that. Steve in Atlanta, Georgia on the line. Hey, Steve, what's on your mind?
I want to know if you read the factcheck.org article about how the Republicans' plan to privatize Social Security won't be that much of a windfall to Wall Street.
Are you talking about the one that was published about a month ago?
March 6, 2005.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't read it word for word, but I'm familiar with it. The problem with that is that they base a lot of that account on another government program that I don't think is a good and valid comparison.
Okay.
But in any case, I'm familiar with that. The Wall Street Journal, in fact, has had several editorials saying, you know, come on, guys, get over it. There's not going to be all this much money for Wall Street. It's still, you know, not this much money. Is Wall Street going to make a trillion? Are they going to make 2 trillion? Or are they only going to make 100 billion or 300 billion? I mean, however much it is, it makes the investment of bribing a few politicians with a few tens or hundreds of millions of dollars cheap.
Right.
Just absolutely cheap. Plus, it satisfies the Ayn Rand libertarian wing of the Republican Party, who believes that we should have, our government, should have no role in socialist programs like Social Security, or for that matter, fire departments and any kind of services. I mean, the water departments, septic, you know, let it all be handled by private corporations.
Do we know the details about this plan?
No.
Okay.
And that's the other thing. I mean, you know, factcheck.org, notwithstanding, the reality is that there is no plan on the table.
Right.
And that's the sad, bizarre, tragic, odd, whatever you want to call it, irony of the ad that Alice called about, which is being run by this group that has hijacked the word progress into their name. I forget the name of it, except that they have progress. They're trying to turn the tables on Center for American Progress and whatnot, and progressives. Mm-hmm. And it's a right-wing group. It's made up of the SWPO veterans folks.
Oh, and, USA.
Yeah, whatever it is, and USA Progress Fund or something like that. And you know, and they're saying, how many ideas to solve the Social Security crisis do Democrats have? Well, number one, that assumes that there's a crisis.
Right.
And number two, it assumes that the Republicans have put forth ideas. Number one, we haven't established that there's a crisis. We know that 40 years from now, if nothing is done, Social Security is going to pay 70% out of Social Security taxes. Well, right now, Medicare within 3 years, Medicare is not going to be paying all of its money out of Medicare taxes. It's going to be paying it out of the general fund. So that's an easy solution, number one. So there's a whole lot of very easy solutions, relatively speaking. But that assumes that there's a crisis, which I say that there's not. And number two, it assumes that the Republicans have put forth a plan, which they haven't. They've, you know, George Bush is running around talking about privatizing, and basically what he's trying to do is he's trying to inculcate, he's trying to indoctrinate young people in the United States to think that it's always better to have private corporations do things in your life than to have the government do things in your life. The government should play no role in civic life. And, you know, he's representing a conservative worldview that has been around for a long, long time, a plutocratic, aristocratic worldview that's been around for a long, long time, and has, you know, a historical coherency to it. It's just one that, you know, every time it's been tried, what happens is you end up with no middle class, a very rich, powerful ruling class, and a whole lot of very poor people. And, sure. You know, and that's the world that's just fine with George, apparently.
That's Steve, all I got, Tom.
Steve, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. 29 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
I'll take you there.
Defending America from the Conservative Weapons of Mass Deception. Tom Hartman here with you. Where despair is not an option, we got to get active. By the way, if you did not hear Cynthia McKinney grilling Don Rumsfeld last week before Congress, I just have to share with you without comment. I'm not going to use this as the basis for a long rant because it pretty much stands alone. The bottom line is that she never got, in my opinion, good answers to these questions. And so the questions are still out there. And in fact, she made the point that she'd asked the questions before and nobody had ever given her. And she'd been told that they couldn't answer them, but they would give her written answers. And she never got the written answers. So anyhow, let me just share with you a few moments of Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney asking questions of Don Rumsfeld.
Lady from Georgia, Ms. McKinney.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Secretary, I watched President Bush deliver a moving speech at the United Nations in September 2003, in which he mentioned the crisis of the sex trade. The president called for the punishment of those involved in this horrible business. But at the very moment of that speech, DynCorp was exposed for having been involved in the buying and selling of young women and children. While all of this was going on, DynCorp kept the Pentagon contract to administer the smallpox and anthrax vaccines and is now working on a plague vaccine through the Joint Vaccine Acquisition Program. Mr. Secretary, is it policy of the U.S. government to reward companies that traffic in women and little girls?
That's her first question. Now, to get to her second question.
That's my first question. My second question, Mr. Secretary, according to the Comptroller General of the United States, there are serious financial management problems at the Pentagon.
Now, listen to these numbers carefully. You realize that a billion is 1,000 million, and a trillion is 1,000 billion. Or a million million. You got that? I mean, you know, a lot of Americans don't know the difference between a billion and a trillion, oddly enough. In fact, it's startling when you look at the studies. So a trillion is 1,000 times a billion, or a million times a million, right? Or a billion times 1,000, in any case, a trillion is a lot of money. And for $1 trillion to be missing out of the Pentagon for 1 year, when the Pentagon's total budget is only about $500 billion a year, it's like, you know, where's all this money coming from? Where's it going? At least it's public budget. I mean, there's this private budget, all this secret stuff. Anyhow, just listen to these numbers.
To which Mr. Cooper alluded. Fiscal year 1999, $2.3 trillion missing. Fiscal year 2000, $1.1 trillion missing.
Say what? $3 trillion? That the Pentagon has lost? This was her second question. Mr. Secretary, Mr. Rumsfeld, you have lost $3 trillion. Where is it?
And DOD is the number one reason why the government can't balance its checkbook.
DOD, of course, being the Department of Defense.
The Pentagon has claimed year after year that the reason it can't account for the money is because its computers don't communicate with each other. My second question, Mr. Secretary, is who has the contracts today to make those systems communicate with each other? How long have they had those contracts? And how much have the taxpayers paid for them?
I will tell you in advance, she got no answer to that question. But in fact, let me just give you her third question, and then we'll give you Rumsfeld's response to her second question.
Finally, Mr. Secretary, after the last hearing, I thought that my office was promised a written response to my question regarding the four war games on September 11th.
War games?
I have not yet received that response, but would like for you to respond to the questions that I've put to you today.
War games?
I do expect the written response to my previous question, hopefully by the end of the week.
War games on 9/11? Well, okay. So first of all, he starts out by saying it's not the policy of the U.S. government to reward companies that are involved in the sex trade. It makes sense. And then Rumsfeld says...
The second question... I've forgotten what the second question was.
It was how much money have you lost, Mr. Rumsfeld? Anyhow, he never answered that. And then the third question, he said, I'm not sure I understand what you mean. And
well, about the promise, Congresswoman, but could you repeat the question to make sure I'm answering the right question? This is 9/11 question.
The question was, we had four war games going on September 11th.
We did.
And the question that I tried to pose before the secretary had to go to lunch was whether or not the activities of the four war games going on September 11th actually impaired our ability to respond to the attacks.
So I will simply let those comments and questions by Congresswoman McKinney stand as they are. Rather startling. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, Roy in Rio Rancho, New Mexico, on the line. Hey, Roy, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Tom. What a brilliant lady. I love her.
Yeah, she's good. I mean, they really went after her. Well, it's a whole other story.
Well, yeah, she was unpatriotic because she was asking questions.
That's right.
You were not supposed to do that.
No.
I was actually calling in on this EPA thing down in Duval County in Florida.
Oh, the Cheers program. Let's give kids pesticides and call it Cheers.
Oh, man. I got involved. I got to looking around on this last fall when it came up. I don't know if I mentioned it before, but my wife's a hypnobirther, so we are very much oriented to paying attention to prenatal and brand-new baby stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And this just infuriated us. And it was this thing that's just... It's been around. It's been laying around for 6 or 8 months, and it just every time it pops its head, it got beat down.
Well, it was laying around during the Clinton administration, and the Clinton administration put a stop to it.
Uh-huh. And all of a sudden now, as tuned in as I am, I was absolutely amazed when I heard you mention that. Because I didn't know about it.
Yeah, not only have they resurrected
it. Because I was paying attention.
and not only have they resurrected this program, but the guy who put it together, the guy who's the lead advocate for it, is now going to be the head of the EPA, the entire agency.
My God. And again, going back to the poverty, I was so touched over this weekend. I was watching C-SPAN 2 with the book notes, and a fellow by the name of Jeffrey Sachs was on. He's with the Millennium Project.
His presentation
was so moving. I just sat there and almost teared up. Ethiopia spends $2 per person per year on their health system. That is the entire health system for you.
Yeah.
And how does that happen? I mean, they can't afford. He said the quote that hit me was, why do they die? Because they can't afford to live. And that's what we're doing with these poor kids down there.
Well, and yeah, it's
go after the poverty.
The scale is exactly somewhat different, but the United States is what 37th in the world now in infant mortality. I mean, we are not. It used to be that we thought that we were number one in the world, and Roy, I just have to share some statistics with you. We are 49th in the world in literacy. We are 28th out of 40 countries in mathematical literacy. 20% of Americans think the sun orbits the earth. 17% believe the earth revolves around the sun once a day. The International Adult Literacy Survey found that Americans with less than 9 years of education scored worse than virtually all of other countries. Our workers lack so many basic skills that American businesses spend $30 billion a year on remedial training. The European Union leads the U.S. in the number of science and engineering graduates. Europe surpassed the United States in the mid-90s as the largest producer of scientific literature. This is grad school stuff. World Health Organization ranked the countries of the world in terms of overall health performance, and the U.S. was 37th. In the fairness of health care, we're 54th. The irony is that this from the European Dream, a World Health Organization publication, page 79. The irony is that the United States spends more per capita for health care than any other nation in the world, yet we are 37th in terms of performance and 54th in terms of fairness. The U.S. and South Africa are the only two developed countries in the world that do not provide health care for all their citizens. And I never thought of South Africa, frankly, as a developed country. I'm sorry.
I didn't either. I was familiar with those statistics, and it's scary. And if I talk to my mother, she's going to tell me this is the greatest place in the world.
Yeah, well, here, lack of health insurance coverage causes 18 1,000 unnecessary American deaths every year. Let's have a culture of life. Let's call Congress together. We have an emergency.
Get on the airplane and go back to Washington. And
yes.
Oh no, we got to.
And there's 18,000 Americans a year unnecessarily die because of lack of health insurance. This is from the New York Times, January 12, 2005. And instead, we've got to call a special Congress. You know, U.S. childhood poverty now ranks 22nd, second to last among the 23 developed nations of the world. You know what country in the world ranks lower? Developed country in the world ranks lower than us? Mexico. That's it. And yeah, I mean, been to Mexico lately? It's whew, more than
and it's the whole mythology of our power just is so it's warped. It's warped, and we have to counteract that myth.
We have to wake people up to the problems that we're facing here in the United States so that we can do something about them.
Solutions.
Yes, so we can do something about them. The leading cause of death of pregnant women in this country is murder. Women are 70% more likely to die in childbirth in the United States than in Europe. We are 40
much more medicalized.
That's right. We are 41st in the world in infant mortality. Cuba has a higher infant mortality or a better infant mortality rate than the United States. Of the 20 developed countries in the world, USA was dead last in the growth rate of total compensation to its workforce in the 1980s. So we're getting poorer. The working people of the world are getting poorer. It just goes on and on and on. Roy, thanks for calling.
Thanks for destroying the myth.
Yeah, well, we need to be out there telling the truth. I appreciate your call. Farmers all abuzz. Honeybees are vanishing. This seems like maybe a strange segue, but I was going to put this on the back end of the giving pesticides to kids story. We had this problem. I remember when this first happened. Because I was writing about it. This was in the early 90s. There was this Asian mite that came to the United States, and this little, you know, eight-armed bug, and it's called the Varroa mite. And they started attaching themselves to honeybees, and I started noticing that here in Vermont, I wasn't seeing honeybees anymore. Instead, in fact, in our garden, in Louise's garden here, I've noticed over this last summer, I don't think I saw a single honeybee. I saw a lot of wasps, I saw bumblebees, and I saw butterflies pollinating flowers, but I didn't see honeybees. And I remember as a kid growing up, there were you had flowers, you had honeybees. No honeybees. There are wasps that sort of look like honeybees, but they're not. They don't have furry bodies. And then there are the great big bumblebees, which are not honeybees. And they're actually a form of wasps. So here we have the honeybees in the 90s. These mites showed up and started killing them off, this parasite. And so they started using these pesticides to try and kill off the mites. And, in fact, most of the wild honeybees in the United States are now dead because of the mites, which has had a substantial impact on our ecosystems. And now they're concerned that the human-grown, the domesticated honeybees are dying off. And this article, more than 15 billion in U.S. crops rides each year on the tiny legs of an insect. That's the honeybee, of course. If honeybees cease to exist, two-thirds of the citrus, all of the watermelons, the blueberries, strawberries, pecans, and beans will disappear, said Jerry Haynes, chairman of apiary inspection with the state's Division of Plant Industry, that in the state of Florida. Under attack from a Southeast Asian parasite, vast numbers of the creatures are dying off. More than 50% of the bees in California have died in the past 6 months. Experts say as many as 40 to 60% of the bees nationwide have died in the last 6 months. An entire hive can be wiped out within less than a year as the parasites, colloquially known as vampire mites, lodge in the hive and begin to reproduce. And the officials are scrambling to try and figure out what to do. Our first response, of course, was pesticides. We sprayed pesticides. It didn't work. I mean, it did work for a little while. It didn't work in that it didn't save the wild honeybees. You will no longer find bee trees, honeybees in old dead trees any longer, like Winnie the Pooh used to find. They're all gone, or mostly. And ultimately, over 25-year period, it didn't save the domesticated honeybees because the mites simply evolved a resistance to the pesticide. So what are we doing about it? Well, the USDA, the American Beef Federation, has asked the U.S. Department of Agriculture to double the $8 million a year that they spend. This is an hour and a half in Iraq. To double the $8 million a year that we spend on bee research to $16 million a year. You would think that the potential loss of most of the food supply of America would be worth more than 15 minutes in Iraq. Or, but I'm sorry, we've got a war to fight and we've got tax cuts for the rich to attend to. First things first. Dennis in Louisville, Kentucky. Hey, Dennis, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, sir?
Good.
It's a pleasure talking to you. First of all, I am a Republican, but I'm just sadly distraught about what the party's doing right now. Just to get on this thing, too, one of the things that I've always heard was that DDT would have actually saved millions of lives in Africa, especially when it's concerning mosquitoes and controlling mosquito populations.
It's a nice myth, Dennis, but DDT actually is still saving lives in Africa. It's being used right now in Africa. There are no prohibitions on it.
Okay, so in the United States, wouldn't it be safe to use it here, too?
No. No, because it was wiping out the birds, it was wiping out the eagles, it was wiping out all the predatory birds, as it is in Africa. We need other solutions, and the other solutions are actually biological. I'll talk about those after we come back from the break. Dennis, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. 10 minutes before the hour. Hi, this is Tom Hartman. With the continuing erosion of the...
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
They seek him here. And welcome back. You say to Dennis in Louisville, plug into Google, myth, M-Y-T-H, space DDT, space Africa, and just read the top link that comes up. Myth, DDT, Africa. I could do a whole show on this. I'm not going to, but the reality is that you've got Dixie Lee Ray and a bunch of other anti-environmentalists running around saying, oh, they stopped DDT and malaria when I worked in Africa in the 1980s. And it's not about DDT or not DDT. So, number one. Number two, there are a lot of good biological ways to solve these problems rather than simply throwing poisons at things. The reason that we've been throwing poisons at things is because they're very profitable to manufacture and they can be patented. But the reality is, for example, in the Soviet Union for years and years, they were using where they didn't have the money and they didn't have corporations that were, and I'm not in favor of the Soviet system at all, please. But nonetheless, they didn't have corporations who were purely driven by the profit motive. They were using phages, P-H-A-G-E-S, a phage. This is to treat bacterial infections. People would have bacterial infections. They would give people a phage. A phage is a virus that infects a bacteria. In other words, they developed viruses that would kill off bacteria. Now, bacteria, by and large, don't develop resistances to phages. They just simply die off. And this is more effective than antibiotics. And they're being now it's the hot new thing. All the research, much of the research that's being done now in the first world is on these phages. The problem is that you can't patent most of them, at least the old ones that have been around for a long time. And and they still work, and they're being used, I can tell you, all around the world. Another possibility would be to breed bees that are resistant to the mites. Find out how the mites hang on. Another one would be to find out something that's a parasite of the mites. There's a lot of ways to go about this program or this to deal with this problem without simply carpeting the country from border to border with poison. And those are the techniques that we need to do. Again, plug in myth DDT in Africa into Google and just read the top link and you'll get my point. Dylan in Toronto, Canada on the line. Hey Dylan, what's up?
Hi, I was just, first off, I was just really glad you brought up the issue of the war games there on 9/11.
Yeah, I didn't bring it up. Cynthia McKinney did, but I didn't realize there were four separate war games going on 9/11.
There were apparently five or more.
Uh-huh, interesting.
Going on, and you see at the end, she asks if they had designated a National Security Day, and the guy, Rumsfeld, says, or the general there said he's not sure, but I'm not even sure what the implications of that, but they look pretty serious. You know, you see the looks on their faces when you watch the video of that.
Right, yeah. And for a general to say, I'm not sure if we designated a National Security Day for 9/11, after all the investigations that have been done of 9/11, is pretty mind-boggling in and of itself.
Oh, yeah. And I just wanted to mention a website and an author, if I could.
Sure.
It's a guy named Mike Rupert. I'm not sure if you're familiar with him.
From the Wilderness.
Yeah, fromthewilderness.com.
Yeah.
And I just read his book, Crossing the Rubicon?
Yeah, I haven't.
Oh, so have you read it?
I think he's a good guy. And Mike says a lot that I agree with, probably much more that I agree with than I disagree with. Occasionally he goes off the deep end in his conspiracy theories, in my opinion.
Okay.
But I don't think that you need a conspiracy for most of this stuff to happen. You just need a whole bunch of people who have the same interests. You know, it doesn't require a secret conspiracy. It's all done out in the open. I think, you know, so much of this stuff. It's just,
well, yeah, and if you look how the book is written too, it's all divided into like a court case.
Yeah.
Into,
yeah,
like means, motive, and opportunity.
Yeah.
And he
go.
Starts the book off by saying, you know, if I find anything that's contrary to anything I've said here, you know, I bring it up. But
yeah.
Anyways, I just wanted to keep it going, you know.
Yeah.
Well,
good on you, Dylan. I appreciate it. And thanks for passing it along and sharing it. I do appreciate it. Mike Ripper does great work. Viagra for your brain. It's the Tom Hartman Program. Thank you for being with us these 3 hours on this beautiful, gray, rainy Monday here in the People's Republic of Vermont. However it is, wherever you are in the country, I hope it's a marvelous day for the rest of the day for you. See you tomorrow, same time, same place.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
This is Veronique Raskin. I'm the president and founder of